on January 23rd, 2008. The first item of business is reentry into the community of incarcerated veterans, Ms. Brown and Max Williams.
Good morning.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Max Williams. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Corrections. It's my pleasure to appear in front of you and the committee this morning. I'm here in cooperation with the Department of Veterans Affairs, and I am here to talk just briefly about an effort that we are making in cooperation with them regarding how we are trying to manage the reentry into the community of current offenders who are incarcerated who have been veterans. My testimony is in front of you, but I'll just make a couple of brief remarks and then allow Ms. Brown to comment. Currently, we have approximately 13,500 offenders in our 14 institutions. 93% of these, as most of you know, will be released from DOC custody at some point at the end of their incarceration and return to the community. 6.7% of our population currently are former veterans who are who have served in the armed services. And in the effort that we're making in the department right now to focus on reentry and transition, one of our great challenges is we try to deal with this 93% of our population that return to the community, is connecting them to resources in the community that will stabilize them when they get out, provide them opportunities for employment, housing, ongoing treatment, medical services, and many of the things that they require in order to return to the community and become productive citizens. And it's our hope, obviously, that they then, in that stable environment, won't recidivate, won't commit a new crime, create a new victim, and ultimately return to the system at a fairly significant expense. In cooperation to try to help us address those issues, because most of those fall outside of the Department of Corrections purview after they've been released. The governor last May initiated through executive order the governor's reentry council, made up of the heads of most of the significant state agencies that have any service delivery to people who would be releasing from prison. DHS, the Employment Department, Veterans, community colleges, and a number of other agencies that are identified as members of the Reentry Council. And the focus of that is to try to figure out how we can collectively break down some of the bureaucracy and the barriers that exist between the agencies in trying to provide services to this population that ultimately ended up on the rolls of almost every one of these other agencies. But the planning upon release and how we might target those specific offenders with a high likelihood of returning to prison wasn't really occurring. And so the work of the Reentry Council has been to try to address those issues. One of the early successes, even before the Reentry Council was formed, was the success that we had in working with the Department of Veterans Affairs. Director Willis and his team, on their own volition, identified that the Department of Corrections housed a number of veterans who were entitled, because of their faithful service to the country, despite their commission of a crime, to certain benefits. And that they were entitled to those benefits legally. And so we worked out a better arrangement than we had previously done in allowing them access to the Department of Corrections. And it was, again, that standard old state agency bureaucracy where they knew they had a population to serve, but our rules weren't necessarily terribly accommodating for how that was going to happen. So we changed the way the rules worked, and we created an opportunity for them to come inside the system, connect with those veterans, and attempt to build releasing plans. For us, it was a tremendous benefit because there isn't enough resources to go around with respect to alcohol and drug treatment or housing or access to medical care for people who are releasing from our institutions. They had resources, many of them actually bought and paid for by the federal government, and we weren't connecting those resources to those people. So now we're doing a better job identifying veterans in our system, and then their people on the ground, and I think you'll have an opportunity to hear from Ms. Conley in a minute, are actually the ones that are coming inside the institution and working directly with our releasing council. counselors, connecting with those offenders who have served in the military, and trying to tie those resources to this population that's releasing out into the community. So it's a great example, I think, of two agencies who figured out that there was a win-win opportunity for us and how we could work better. And it's one of the examples we're using in our work with the Reentry Council to try to do the same thing with other sister state agencies who have a significant impact on what happens to these offenders when they release out, and how we make those connections work and operate better in providing those very scarce resources. So that's essentially what I wanted to share with the committee today. You've got my testimony that has some of the statistics in it. I'd be happy to take any questions, and I know Ms. Brown and Ms. Conley also have some information to add about how this program works.
Any questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, please.
And Representative Shoffer?
Thank you. Maybe Ms. Brown later will answer this question. My brother, who is a veteran, he now owns our parents' house. We arranged it all he has to do is pay the taxes. It's owned free and clear because he didn't have anywhere to live. He lived with my parents. And he has a lot of resources that a lot of people don't have, and I'm grateful for that because he's really lucky and he'll always have a place to live and be able to feed himself. And the government is responsible for a lot of that too, I might add. He gets a lot of assistance from the government, allows him to do a lot of things that I know a lot of veterans can't, and I'm eternally grateful for that because he suffers from a lot of mental illness and a lot of issues, but he has a support system around him. There's been a lot of media hype lately, and people from all sides of the aisle use this for political gain, and it's sickening, but there's been a lot of discussion about homeless veterans. Are there statistics showing how many veterans are homeless at the time of their incarceration, and why they're homeless? You know, I'd imagine primarily it is due to some kind of mental illness or struggle with drugs and alcohol, or all of the above. And I'm not suggesting, Mr. Williams, that you give me all the answers to those questions or Ms. Brown today, but I would like to see that statistic. Because if we can't, especially combat veterans, which my brother's not one, if we can't provide these men and women with somewhere to live after they go over there and get shot at, you know, that's a pretty bad statement about what kind of community we are. I don't care if you're Republican or a Democrat or what you are. So that's what that was my question. If you could provide that with us later, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shoffler, we do a fair amount of work at intake to sort of determine the issues that an individual might have, because we start planning for release at the moment that they come into our system. I don't know specifically on the housing front whether we're going to be able to identify whether they did or they didn't have an address, but we can probably come to a fairly close approximation given some of that data. And we'll certainly do our part, and I know we'll be happy to work with the department as well with any information they have and respond.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Rems, I want to thank the department for changing the rules to help do this. I think that's important, and we appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Ms. Brown.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paula Brown. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and I'm here to share some information as well on a high-level, policy-level issue. The department is very happy to be involved with the Reentry Council. And we do have a great relationship with the Department of Corrections, and I commend them for the efforts that they've made, because they've been very accommodating. And the good thing about it is the focus has been on the veteran. And as the two agencies have collaborated and cooperated and worked on this together, however you want to describe it, in the end, the beneficiary is the veteran. And the goal is so that when those veterans come out, we are making sure that we are serving those honorably discharged veterans who, for whatever reason, now find themselves incarcerated. That's different from their military service. It doesn't change the fact that they served their country honorably. It doesn't change the fact that they're entitled and have earned through their military service a number of veterans' benefits. And the department's very pleased to be able to, in whatever way we can, assist them in accessing those benefits to help them prepare for a successful transition to the community and success afterwards, whether that's going to be a place to live, help them with employment, and all of the issues that they're going to be facing. And I think that collaborative effort is going to help help us see a lot more successful veterans who come out after incarceration. And with the committee's permission, I'd like to invite Val Conley up. She's our Veteran Services Administrator, and she can tell you a lot more about the nuts and bolts of how we actually work when we get in there.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, please. Debbie, that's construction noise going on. Your phone's working just fine.
I'm going to log in because I can't quite hear the people talking at the mic, so I'm working on that. I might be able to hear it better. I'm putting one ear into that and one on the phone.
Okay.
Hey, Max, does this reach?
Probably not.
It won't reach, but yeah. If you please speak into the microphone as much as you can.
Sure.
Identify yourself for the record, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Val Conley. I am Administrator of Veterans Services Division for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And last spring, we hooked up with the Department of Corrections, and we made arrangements for about six of our ODVA staff to get Department of Corrections identification so that our staff could get into the state facilities a little more easily than we had in the past to make it easier to see the incarcerated veterans. Now, right now, our goal is to reach every veteran that is currently incarcerated, and I'm currently working with Ginger Martin on Max's staff to get lists of every veteran that is currently incarcerated. And the reason we want to do that, and we want to get them as early as we possibly can, is that a lot of people don't understand that veterans can receive compensation while they are incarcerated. Mm-hmm. Now, they will receive it at a reduced rate from what they were receiving prior to being incarcerated, but if they're 100%, they can receive, it will be reduced to 10% on the 61st day of incarceration for a felony. But that's $117 a month. And money, when you're incarcerated, is at a premium. And my understanding is that it increases the quality of life while you're incarcerated if you do have some money to spend. Another thing that we do is we can apply for an apportionment of the veterans' compensation for family members based on need. So if a veteran is incarcerated, he's 100%, he gets $2,700 a month. He's reduced down to 117. His spouse, children can apply for an apportionment of the rest of those benefits, approximately $2,600 tax-free dollars based on need. So it's very important that we reach them as early as we possibly can. If there's veterans who are over 65 who are incarcerated, they're wartime veterans. We can get them on veterans pension once they are released from incarceration. That way they have an income. It's approximately $1,000 a month. It's not huge, but it may prevent them from entering homelessness as soon as they're discharged out of the institution. Once they are released, we can get them their full compensation benefits. They have the potential for entering the VA Voc Rehab program, which is one of the best programs in the nation, getting them training, getting them in college, on-the-job training. We can get them hooked up with veterans employment reps, some who specialize in employment with disabled veterans. We can get them into alcohol and drug programs. And at a minimum, if we can reach them 6 months prior to discharge out of the facility, we can get them hooked up with medical benefits. So if they're not entitled to anything else, at least they will have health care once they are discharged out of the facility.
Okay, thank you. Any questions?
Yeah, please, thank you. It's interesting. I'm glad I have all this personal family experience because it helps me a lot see what people are going through. My mother, who's a newcomer to Oregon, when she moved from Iowa to Chicago to live with my sister for a year after my father passed away, somehow the paperwork lapsed and her veterans benefit that she got from my dad lapsed and was discontinued. And since then, my brother's moved her out here. She's in a foster care home. And we're trying to, through the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, get that reinstated, and I'm fairly confident we'll be able to. But my question to that right there, as far as when someone's incarcerated, whether they're retired or not, or especially if they have a dependent at home, a wife or a spouse or children, is when they, and you said up to $2,600 a month, if that is somehow cut off or lapses due to their incarceration, is, and then the family comes in and asks for a reinstatement or whatever the benefit is that retrospective from when it was cut off, or is it just prospective from when they get it reinstated?
It's not retroactive.
Huh.
No.
Okay.
Those benefits just go away if they're not, if then, they're not used.
And then follow up, please.
Follow up, please.
Then do you automatically go out and start the process once that veteran's incarcerated to shorten that time period for those dependents, because they're going to need that money in some cases, or how does that work? Do they have to come and request it?
If we know they're there, and that's why it's real important to know that a veteran is incarcerated. Mm-hmm. If we don't know,
right,
we can't reach them. Okay. So it's real important that we know as soon as they enter the door of an institution that they are a veteran.
Right.
And if they are receiving compensation at that time, that's important for us to know, too, if there is a family waiting. Because most families don't understand that they are entitled to apply for an apportionment of that veteran's benefits.
All right, Mr. Chair, then one more question, please. Then do you... is it explained to the new person that's thrown in jail that if they are a veteran, these things are available? Or is there any kind of explanation at the gate of what's available or not? And some people would say, no, it's not our job to explain that, probably. Mm-hmm. But is there any kind of process like that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schaffler, one of the things we've learned through our working with the Department of Veterans Affairs is that we weren't doing a particularly good job of screening as people came into the intake center who was and who wasn't a veteran. So one of the things we're trying to do now at our point of intake is really to clarify that and then to develop that list and provide that list to the department. That's doing a good job for us on the people that are coming in since we've sort of instituted this. We obviously have people in the system that are veterans that we might not know about because we weren't doing that kind of screening before. There are at some of the institutions, there are actually veterans clubs where incarcerated veterans of particularly the penitentiary, there's a fairly active veterans club, and they've been pretty good about helping identify people in the institutions that are veterans, and we've used that information as well. So we're trying hard to do that catch early, and it is exactly as Ms. Conley stated. The sooner we can identify them, they can get in and have a conversation with them about what benefit options there are, they can actually start the process to try to get these benefits flowing to family members if the need is established and all that works. I think for me, one of the key points that Ms. Conley made is that there are really very finite resources available for people who are releasing from prison. And you might look at the list and say, well, out of 13,000, you know, 500 inmates, only 906 are veterans. But that's 906 people who have potential access to health care, potential access to subsidy money that could help them in housing, access to drug and alcohol treatment. And that's a substantial number of people that can be being served and are entitled to be served through the resources that the department accesses through federal dollars that aren't state dollars. So it's also an issue about stretching that and making those state dollars go further, because we're finding a way to address this group of people through other resources that in some cases are better resources than I could offer most other releasing offenders. And to think that we're missing any one person coming out who could be getting access to medical care, mental health treatment, alcohol and drug treatment, a housing subsidy, and potentially their full benefit restoration, that would be a real disappointing thing to miss that for somebody, particularly when that increases substantially that person's likelihood of committing a new crime, creating a new victim, and coming back into the system at a cost of, you know, on average probably a couple of $100,000 by the time it's all said and done. So every single one of these people we can actually identify, catch, and get resources that doesn't, as a result of that, commit a new crime. There's a huge savings that isn't necessarily recognized, but is a true savings to the system because of the access to these resources. So it's real important work, and we're very dedicated to trying to work together to make it happen.
Thank you. Yeah. Mr. Chairman,
There's a panel. What check do you do to determine that the person is a veteran? That's the first question. And secondly, will you be keeping track of the veterans as it relates to recidivism rates for the purposes of statistics and studies?
Mr. Chairman and Council Taylor, the approach that we've got, I think, is we simply ask at the time they come in. We then identify who that individual is, and we provide it to the department. I think they do the work to actually determine whether or not they're the only ones who really have the authority to determine whether or not somebody's a qualifying veteran or not. So, you know, they can tell us whatever they want. Obviously, the department will do its homework to determine whether or not, you know, they've got the right numbers and that it is who they say they are and their service was what they said it was, and they'll do all of that verification. I don't know. I can honestly say I'm not aware right now that we are individually tracking veterans and these services being provided and then following them through. If we know who they are on the list, it's quite easy for us to do follow-up, you know, 1, 2, and 3 years afterwards to see what kind of actions have happened and whether or not they've committed a new crime and come back into the system. But I don't know that we've actually identified this population as a group that we're tracking at this point independently.
Thank you.
Any further questions? I just want to comment on Ms. Brown said that the veterans really a beneficiary of that program. Our communities a true beneficiary as well. We get these people back on their feet and not, Mr. Williams said, recycling back through the system. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Was there anybody else wanted to testify on this item? Okay, the next item on the agenda is the deployment of 3,200 Oregon National Guard men and women in January 2009 and how this will impact Oregon. General Caldwell and Mr. Evans, please. Whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Military Department. Pleasure to be here today.
Thank you.
Hope Representative Boone is feeling better soon so we can get her in, get her here. And can you hear us fine there, Representative? Guess not.
Yeah. Representative Boone?
She's probably on the Internet
yeah.
now.
Yeah.
I'm sure she's looking good, no matter how she's feeling.
I'm sure. The committee asked that we come today and discuss the impacts or the and the proposed or the not proposed, but the definite deployment of the 41st Brigade Combat Team, which is scheduled to depart Oregon about a year from this coming June for a 12-month tour in Iraq.
Are you there?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, you just want to be sure you can hear.
I
hope you.
I can hear. I've got my...
computer. Still there? Good. Go ahead. Just
okay.
Go ahead. I think she can hear on the...
Just to kind of give you an idea of the... of the impact right now, the brigade is authorized 3,438 positions. We currently have a fill of 94.4% or 3,250 individuals. Some of those vacancies will be transfers out of other units that we'll have to fill in. A little bit less than 200 at this point that we'll be taking from other units in the state. To give you a perspective, the Army National Guard of the state of Oregon is 6,400 people. The Air National Guard is 2,100 people for a grand total around 8,500, give or take a few. So, in essence, we're going to have close to 5,000 guardsmen remaining. The map I presented to you kind of gives you an idea of where these units are located. And as you can see, it basically runs the I-5 corridor predominantly. It starts out in St. Helens, and we have a small unit over at Camp Ryalea. And then it goes right down the I-5 corridor to the California border. So clearly there's going to be a significant reduction of available soldiers in those particular areas, because as you get to the more populated centers in the Willamette Valley, we have additional units from the other brigade that, you know, that are still in the state and still available for a state emergency or for anything the governor may need or require. The other major units that we have, one is a 1249th Engineer Battalion, which is headquartered here in Salem, and it has units predominantly in the Willamette Valley as well. They've got two units actually right now currently in Iraq, which will be back this spring. So they'll be about 100% by the time the 41st Brigade leaves. And then our other major unit, of course, is in Eastern Oregon with the 3rd of the 116th Cavalry. The big issue that we're looking at, in each one of these units, by the way, each major headquarters will retain a rear detachment. Out of that 3,500 folks that are going to be departing, we'll maintain a rear detachment of a small number of people, probably somewhere in the neighborhood of, at the battalion level, somewhere around the neighborhood of probably 6 to 10. But the major issue, of course, is their equipment will go with them. And so now that we're getting our equipment back and restored after the first iteration of deployments, and we're picking up new trucks and new everything, basically, and rebuilt items in other areas, that equipment will all pack up and depart. So we are looking at other schemes to move equipment over to the west side from the east side and put parts of it on this side of the hill so we can actually respond to any need that the governor may have. So we think that and then on top of that, of course, we have the Air National Guard, which is primarily headquartered at two air bases, Portland Air Base, and then, of course, Klamath Falls. We have a small unit out at Camp Ryalea, and it's each one of these organizations has a good supply of trucks and Humvees and other equipment that can be used in case of an emergency. So we're going to rely heavily on the two Air National Guard units to kind of, I guess, corner post the state on the south end and the north end of Interstate 5. So with that, I would say that we're concerned in the sense that we're going to have armories that won't be able to respond perhaps as quickly as we would like. But I think we're looking at a 24-hour period. We can pretty much get anything, any place in Oregon in 24 hours or less. And we think that with a little bit of pre-planning and a little bit of pre-stationing of some of the equipment out of Eastern Oregon and Central Oregon, that we'll be able to respond appropriately during an emergency. Now, if we have a catastrophic event, tsunami that hits the entire coast, then we already know that we probably couldn't handle that anyway, so we would be using the Interstate Compact, which we've started to really work with Idaho, because thinking of the tsunami scenario, then Washington's going to be in a similar situation, and we would need Idaho and Montana to come in and help us more than likely, or Nevada, and perhaps California. So we're really making those relationships strong right now. We've had a meeting last week with the state of Idaho and their emergency management operation. And they, too, are organized like Oregon, where the emergency management operation is in the military department. So we had this discussion about this very thing. It said when we send this brigade out, we may very well need you to start thinking about, first attack type teams that you guys can put together rapidly and get them over our way. And then last but not least, we, of course, would go to the big Army and the big Air Force through Northern Command and ask them to come in. But those are 24 to 48 hours out. So the immediate response that we may need, as we saw in December, where we had not a lot of vehicles, we had probably 10, 15 vehicles that responded on the day of the event, and probably half of those headed for Vernonia, and only a few of them ended up making it, but nevertheless, they did make it, and I think the ability for us to respond quickly made a big difference in the situation at Vernonia as well as on the northern coast. So again, we're certainly mindful of what this impact could be. We're mindful of what we need to do in order to secure ourselves and ensure that we can respond in a timely fashion. I think the bigger issue is if we get multiple deployments stacked on top of each other, which we don't forecast right now. It's not in the forecast. But if that happened, then I think we'd have to reconsider how we're operating right now and probably look at some other alternatives. The 3rd of the 116th is actually scheduled to deploy in 2011. So there, we get one out, get them back, and we send another one out. And those are big units. So it doesn't, the horizon doesn't forecast any lull in this deployment cycle.
Thank you. And I it's for both you gentlemen, I guess. One is that in another committee I'm on, we passed out and we're going to put into statute, I believe it is, that Pacific Emergency Management Act. I'd imagine that will help. I hope it will. And then my second question is, when I see the word armory, I envision huge stores of armaments and guns and bullets and bombs and stuff. Just exactly, I mean, is this mostly for equipment? And how secure are these? I mean, clear out and burns, is that all? Do you have people stationed there securing those armories, or how does that all work?
Imagine all across the country
like this, too.
Mr. Chairman, Vice Chair Schaffler, indeed, we have soldiers at each one of these facilities, depending on the facilities. Burns, as an example, is a company size headquarters, and so typically we'll have three people in that facility. There'll be an administrative officer, NCO, non-commissioned officer. There'll be a training non-commissioned officer, and there'll be a supply non-commissioned officer. Right now, Burns only has two. Occasionally, you'll have a third or fourth person, depending on the makeup, with a recruiter. But that's pretty typical of the operation. Each one of our facilities, the majority of them were built post-World War II. So they are generally a post-World War II idea of what a unit should have, and most of the units then were infantry units. So they didn't have a lot of equipment. They didn't have many trucks. They didn't have much of anything. They had basically a rucksack and a rifle. Each one of them have a vault inside of it that's monitored 24/7 by the local police department, and also monitored here by us on a 24/7 basis electronically. There's three different levels of security to get toward that vault. It's all electronic. If it goes south, then if something happens, we immediately have the police respond locally, and then we also activate into the state police, and then we get our people on the ground with keys and codes and everything else to find out what's going on. It's a very secure system. You may recall probably 30 years ago now, but there was an armory in California that was broken into during the height of the protest era, and I think they got somewhere in the neighborhood a couple hundred M16 rifles. And they did a very effective job. They knew what they were doing. They got them out. To my knowledge, they never found the rifles, but that prompted the federal government to spend millions of dollars to come in and put security systems on all these facilities. So every one of our facilities is well monitored and well secured at this point. The general buildings are, like I said, late 1940s, early 1950s vintage. We're working through the legislature every year in our budget requests and through the Congress to try to get funds to rebuild these things and modernize them. And in one case, this past legislative session, we were fortunate enough to pick up $12 million worth of bonding authority here in the state of Oregon to go back to some of our older ones that we do not see a path in the next 20 years of rebuilding and modernize those four armories. Those right now are scheduled for Gresham, St. Helens, Woodburn, and Newport. And those are four of our older facilities. Our oldest armory was built in 1911, and it sits in Dallas, which we're about ready to move out of because we have a wall. It's the building staying stationary, and the wall's going north. And so we've shut off about half of that facility because we can't use it safety-wise, and we're looking at alternatives presently on how to resolve that. So we have our problems. That is probably the second oldest one is in Cottage Grove. I think it was built in 1915. We have a new armory being built, a new facility being built that includes the Navy, the Marine Corps, the Forest Service, and the BLM in Springfield, and us. We're going to consolidate the units in Eugene and Cottage Grove into that unit in Springfield. It's a massive building. It's about 100,000 square feet or something of that nature. And it's going, being constructed as we speak. It should be done in about 12 months. So those are some of the things that we've done. That we've tried to consolidate, tried to get our footprint smaller, but when you do that, you lose recruiting. If you're not in the community, we've learned that you don't recruit. Best example I could give you is we used to have an armory in Silverton. During the budget cuts of the post-ballot Measure 5 era, we closed four armories. We closed Silverton, Oregon City, which we still maintain, we still own it, Newburg, and Tillamook. We raised the building in Tillamook. It was about a 1910 vintage, so it went flat. The Newburg Armory got turned into a youth center, I believe. We still maintain the Oregon City Armory, and the Silverton Armory is currently occupied by the city. They got a 99-year lease for $1 a year. Legislatively directed, I might add. That building was about a 1920 vintage building. At one time, we had 125 soldiers in that unit in Silverton. We had the mistaken belief in the early 90s that if we simply made it acceptable for those folks to come into Salem to drill, that we'd maintain them all. The last time I ran the zip codes, which was about a year ago, for Silverton, we had two soldiers left in that unit. Newburg was similar. I think we had five in Newburg that went to McMinnville that are remaining from that change. And we used to have a headquarters company there, which was almost 200 people. So we know for a fact in mid-sized town Oregon that if you close an armory, you will not penetrate that recruiting base. So we are loath to do that any longer, and anything we can do to increase our reach inside the communities we think is better for us and better for the communities. Now, the good news side is we did open an armory in Prineville, which was a former OYA facility. Unfortunately, as you would put an OYA facility out in the middle of nowhere so nobody could see it, nobody could find it, because you got kids, you know, incarcerated kids, well, that doesn't lend itself real well for community activities when you do that. Nevertheless, we're there. It's working. It's slow getting going. We've been in there about 2 years now. We've done some conversions on the facilities, which obviously it was built for some other purpose. We're making it work, and we hope to establish a larger footprint in Prineville, as that part of the state is really growing, as we all know. So that's kind of a quick overview of where we're at with our facilities.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Chairman of the committee, I can add a little bit to the security issue, because I was in the National Guard at the same period, and I was stationed in Commonwealth Ave, surrounded by about 200,000 college students. And they used to separate the bolts from the M16s. The M16s were put in one part of the armory, and the bolts were put in another part.
That's correct. That's still a practice today. They do that. They separate them. They put them in sleeves. Everybody knows where those sleeves are. And then they put them in a separate secure facility. So even if you get the M16, you're going to get a rifle, but you got to find a bolt, which would be rather difficult. But like I said, I think that was around 1973, 74 when that robbery or that burglary took place. And the fascinating thing was not only did they never find the people who did it, they never found the weapons. So they probably went to the third world. And that's where they got marketed.
I do have a question. How many of these men that are being deployed for the second and third time?
I don't know that exactly. I will tell you that just as a good guess, that over half will be on at least their second deployment. Probably 10 to 15% of them will be on their third deployment. So you're looking at probably somewhere around 30% or so of these folks have never deployed, and the other 70 probably have.
They're deployed for a year, 14 months?
The Army has actually changed after a good deal of debate and frustration by the National Guard community nationwide. The Army has finally come to the realization that they need to accommodate our needs, and one of those needs was this long deployment. If you're an active duty member, you get deployed, you leave your post with your home and your family for 12 months, and then you're back. And the Guard, the Army believed that we couldn't walk and chew gum simultaneously, so therefore they had to run everybody through this battery of you got to prove yourself before we'll deploy you. That usually took somewhere between 90 and 120 days, and then you got shipped to Iraq or Afghanistan, and then you did 12 months from that point. So after, like I said, a good deal of debate and consternation and complaints, the Army said, you know, you're right. You guys are pretty good. We were probably misjudged you a little bit. So what we're going to do now is we're going to allow you, the Adjutant General in the state, to work a select team. We're going to give you the money to start this preparatory training that we believe you need to have and validate that training. And if you sign off on it, Adjutant General, and says these people can do the X, Y, and Z, the basics, then we're going to accept that, and that'll reduce that pre-deployment time at Camp Swampy, wherever that may be, to probably somewhere between 30 and 60 days, if not less, which then puts them in country for 12 months. So the typical rotation is going to be, the Secretary of Defense said it would be 12 months. There's no way they can do that right now, so it's going to average about 14. And the goal is to get it down to so the whole period of time, from the time you deploy till the time you're back, will be 12 months. And I suspect we'll see that happening probably in the next year.
Thank you. Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'll move us closer so Representative Boone can hear me. I want to add just a couple of things to the discussion that's already been put forward by General Caldwell. And as a policy advisor, I can say some things that the military doesn't want to say. This is going to have a tremendous impact on the state, bottom line. You can't take 3,200 military members away and impact the 3,200 families that are associated with that deployment and not have an impact that spans across the spectrum of policies. That said, there's really three specific categories I want to talk to, and then I want to explain the eye chart that I handed up to you a little bit ago. The first is the December storms were mentioned earlier, and it was the first time that the emergency management under the military department was able to field itself, and I think it proved itself. Those lessons learned are being put back into the system, and new protocols are being developed, and I think Oregon is over the long term going to be well served by that. The thing that needs to be remembered with this particular deployment, though, is it's not the first, nor will it be the last deployment that we're going to have National Guard folks away. With the transition of the National Guard and Reserve into an operational reserve as opposed to a strategic reserve, we have to factor in a process that at any given time has a number of our folks out of state. Now, that's not something to run around screaming about, but at the same time, it's something that we have to recognize and we have to plan for. Some of the programs and ideas and proposals that are going to be coming toward the legislative session in 2009 will emphasize a plus-up in the OEM capacity in terms of both what we think of in terms of armories, at least in the case of 10 to 12 of them, making them not only solid armories for the training and the support for National Guard units, but also an emergency management response and recovery facility that has extra generators and extra water and extra provisions and communications, so that when we have, especially when we have large numbers of military members out of state, we still have some capacity for deployed, so we can cut that response time down just a little bit. We also recognize, in terms of the capacity to respond, the trucks and the other equipment that's going to be out of state, there's no guarantee long-term that we're going to get all that back. At some point, and General Cole has said this on a number of different occasions, at some point when the music stops and Iraq and Afghanistan are done and the folks in the Pentagon start figuring out who gets what, it's very possible we're going to end up with not everything that we sent at some point. Now, that may not be in 09, maybe in an out year, but we have to recognize that going in and make sure that as we develop policies that have the military and OEM combined together, we're looking at that question of capacity. We're looking at that question of making sure that we can meet the worst case possible need. That's why Vice Chair Schaffer, your discussion about PNEMA is so important. We have to have everything available, every tool in our tool chest for when that tsunami or when that earthquake or when that tragic event occurs. So from the state perspective, the governor's concerned about the impact of the soldiers away. The governor has no doubt that the National Guard will answer the call and do everything possible, everything humanly possible in times of disaster. But policymakers, we need to recognize that there will be an impact, and we need to find ways to make it easier for the National Guard to fulfill some of those functions. In terms of its impact on veterans and families, the eye chart you see up in front of you, I'd just like to give a couple of pieces of information that hopefully will help provide a little bit of context. Soon, hopefully in February, there will be a working group around veteran services. This task force will put forward the opportunity for different cohorts of veterans and different veterans groups to be around the same table. We've been working with the committee staff on this and Representative Barker, but the idea is to have folks sitting around the table and make sure that we understand what policies are in place, how well they're working, what things aren't being done, what gaps there are, whether they're state or federal concerns, so we can come in 2009 and make sure through the legislative process that when this particular 3,200 folks come back in 2010, we have some of those fixes in place. And the reason that there's a sense of urgency to make sure that we do that is, in fact, that for a number of those 3,200, it is their second or third deployment. And that's not just for the military member. Again, for the family, that's their second or third deployment. And just from my own personal experience in the last 6 years, I can tell you that most guys and gals can survive the first deployment and they can make things work. It's that second one that you have a huge increase in relationship issues, in job issues, in potential dependency issues. And we have the benefit of knowing that that chunk of people are going to be gone. So now we have the responsibility to work together and try to find those fixes and implement them and make sure that they're working before the fact. The last thing I'd like to mention is that there is a program that it's a pilot program over in the City of Independence, and I want to make this committee aware of that pilot program. One of the things that, as we've been working through the reintegration process and looking at some of the veterans' activities ongoing throughout the state, one of the things that was identified was that, unlike World War II in Korea, where there were VFW halls and American Legion halls around everywhere, in many communities there's not a place for veterans to gather, at least like they used to. And the state can't really afford to build a veteran center in every community, but there's still a need for some of those veteran services and an outreach approach in the communities. So in a partnership, the military department, ODVA, the Federal Veterans Administration, local partners, and the City of Independence in this particular case, and a group that has a building, starting, I believe, the first week of February on Thursdays from 2 in the afternoon through 11 o'clock at night, there's going to be planned and unplanned time set aside for veterans and families that will be an outreach program that will provide in the afternoon opportunities for veterans benefits information, opportunities about education, employment, those kinds of outreach things. There'll be some family planning counseling available, and then there'll be 3 to 4 hours every Thursday, I think it is, available for vets to be around other vets and have an opportunity just to kind of be around their peers. It's a pilot program. I plan on giving you updates as we kind of meet some of the markers as we go throughout the process. But the goal for this, quite frankly, is to see if it works. And if it works, using a facility that's already built and partnerships in the area, to come back to the legislature in 2009 and showcase a model for assistance throughout the rest of the state. Because the thing we need to remember also about the National Guard and Reserve, as the general talked about, is they're spread all over the state. And those communities, different communities have different needs, but it is up to us to make sure that we at least put them cost-effective manner possible. So those are two things that are floating out there that I'll come back to you on as time goes on. But this deployment of 3,200 folks is a big concern. But in context, it's not the last deployment that we're going to have. So a lot of these issues that we need to deal with, we need to be kind of thinking beyond 2009. Thank you.
Questions, comments? Thank you very much.
Appreciate the opportunity to come before you today.
Thank you.
Yes.
Was that Paul Evans talking?
Yes, it was.
Just to remind the committee and people about sergeant hires program in the community colleges. And hopefully we'll see more of those, and ideally in every community college around the state, which would give us 17
Okay, thank you. What she was talking about was some of the programs in the community colleges, and hopefully they will be expanded to provide more centers for people.
Just a quick overview of what Representative Boone was mentioning. We currently have 3 community colleges that are actively involved with us with respect to providing space for veterans to assemble and come in and get assistance and or counseling or whatever program they may need. actually two community colleges and one university, Portland State University, Clackamas Community College, and Lane Community College. And basically they've done this out of Hyde. Jim Willis's ODBA has supported all three of those with his staff, and I think some money to get them computers and this sort of thing. The colleges, on the other hand, have provided space and heat and lights and that sort of thing. There's, you know, basically space. But thanks to ODVA and Sergeant Hire's efforts to find that place where veteran students can come in and be dealt with appropriately and learn, find out what their benefits may or may not be, or find out what other opportunities are for them, has panned out very well in the three places that we're doing it. So we would like to see that expanded, but that's going to take some effort.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, please, thank you. Yeah, I it's kind of off the subject just a little bit, but I remember in my reading years ago about the Vietnam War, and I can't remember if this was a recruitment tool or what, but they when they went out and requested that people sign back up for a second or third tour, they were told that for every person that does sign up, because of their, for lack of a better word, journeyman skills out there in the combat field, they were actually going to save some American lives because they knew what to look for. I don't know if you're familiar with that or not, but was that true then, and is it true now? I'm trying to look for a bright side for redeploying people with experience in combat situations. Is there any statistics showing that happening in Iraq or Afghanistan?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Choffler, I'm sure that there's probably some studies that, you know, we can dig far enough and deep enough, we'll find them. I can tell you anecdotally, from everything that we know, indeed, that combat experience makes a tremendous difference in how these folks perform on their second or third iteration. Most generally, I would say probably 99% of the time it's very positive that they have it. There's probably 1% of the time, maybe 2 or 3, that it actually is an impediment.
Right.
And there's also that factor that comes into play because of, you know, people previous experiences become too cautious or just simply can't function as well as they did perhaps the first go around. But generally speaking, that's an accurate statement. We know that the real advantage for us has been that these combat veterans have done such a wonderful job with the soldiers that are enlisting, the young people coming in, of really getting them prepared. And I think that's where the real advantage comes, is that they can give them first-hand experience. They've been there. They know it. They know what to look for, how to operate, how to act, you know, what will assist you in staying alive and what won't. And I think those are the important aspects that we've noticed, certainly in our training and environments that we've had these combat veterans in. It's been extremely positive for the younger people.
Thank you.
Sir, members of the committee, General, can you tell me currently what are the college benefits that the federal government gives to a veteran, say someone who's coming out of the Oregon National Guard after being a year or so in Iraq?
It's a mixed bag. And there's a good deal of discussion going on at the congressional level over this very thing. If you're an active duty soldier, you can elect to put so much money a month into a fund, and the federal government or your service matches that, and then when you get out, you have your version of the GI Bill. If you're in the National Guard, you actually, when you sign up, you're eligible for what's termed the Montgomery GI Bill, which gives you up to 4 years worth of educational benefits at around $450 a month that you receive every month you're in school. Now, you have to stay in the National Guard in order to collect that benefit, whereas the active duty benefit, once you get out, you have that benefit sitting on the table waiting for you, and you can choose to not stay engaged in the service and come out and go to college. Where in the Guard, you can't. The minute you get out of the National Guard, your benefits cease. Recently, a group out of Minnesota National Guard was extended during the surge. Their tour of duty was supposed to be 12 months in country. They did the typical 16 months total iteration time to train up, as I explained earlier. And then they got extended. And so they ended up doing 22 months, I believe. All of those, there was Congress did pass along this last session to say that we're going to make a special provision for these people because many of them said, I'm not going to reenlist, I'm not going to stick around, and now I am really screwed because I can't get any educational benefit, and I did as much time, if not more, than the typical active duty guy does. So they did make some provisions to try to accommodate that one unit out of Minnesota, but I think you're going to see some more efforts this time around to balance that out, make it a more fair situation than it is today, particularly for those that are, as indicated in the Minnesota case, and even those that maybe, you know, have done the second tour, or maybe they just did the one tour and it was overly long. So I think you'll see some changes there, but that's pretty much what it is. The other benefit that we have for people in the Guard, you can also get, on top of the $450 a month, I think it's $440, $450, you can get what's termed tuition assistance from the federal government. So up to, I think it's 9 or 10 hours, that the federal government will actually pay the cost of that college course. So you get that paid for plus the $450 Montgomery GI Bill. And on top of that, what we've done here in Oregon, and much mainly due to the work of the previous veterans committees, and this committee also did some help on it this last session, which we fund what's termed the Oregon National Guard Tuition Assistance Program. Currently has about $500,000 in it, I think was appropriated last session. And that money, is we use that very judiciously because we're looking for those situations where an individual perhaps maybe used up their Montgomery GI Bill, hadn't finished college, mainly because of deployments, didn't have any more quarters left on it, or we ran out of money on the federal side and couldn't do the tuition assistance, then we employ the state money to pay for that tuition assistance. I think that fund is somewhere around 300 and some thousand left in it right now, so high 300s, and I would say that we've used probably about 100, 125,000 of it since July, of just filling the holes to make sure that these young men and women who want to go to school can go to school. So if you're a guardsman, you need to stay in the Guard. That's the whole idea, is keep stay in the Guard, and that was the whole incentive behind the Montgomery GI Bill to begin with. I think it does deserve some congressional tweaking. At the same token, I think it also is a great incentive to keep people in the National Guard and keep them going to school, which is important to us. I think if I was king for the day, I would probably set up a situation where we could guarantee our people that you're going to get at least an associate's degree in a community college, and we're going to, with your federal benefits, whatever they may be, and whatever the difference is between that and what we need to employ, we'll guarantee you a associate's degree. I think we'd be better off as a state and better off as a society if we did something to that effect. I couldn't tell you what it cost. Most of our soldiers go to community college. The majority of them are community college folks, not university folks. So I think looking at those statistics, if I was king, I'd say we're going to guarantee that. You've got a right to do it, and you got 10 years to get it done. So if you change your mind after you get back, you get out, we're still going to take care of you.
Chair Barker and Mr. Taylor, members of the committee. Two things on this. First is Governor Kongoski for 2009 is directed staff to work with the congressional folks to try to develop a proposal for an Oregon GI Bill supplement. So if you're a National Guard reservist, but specifically the National Guard, that there's a additional money. Not the GI Bill doesn't exactly pay for everything. And there's a recognition that folks can get the full GI Bill and still have needs in terms of books and rent and those types of things. So in 2009, you can expect a proposal related to trying to put a supplemental in for folks to marry up with the federal program that people take, that they're entitled to. To the earlier question, Vice Chair Schaffler, I absolutely agree with General Colwell about the impact of prior combat experience on training young troops and on the 99 probably percentile of how it helps a soldier or an airman to have been in those situations before. As a vet who was in Iraq twice and Afghanistan once and a couple places around the world before then, I can tell you there's two things that need to be recognized in this context. The first is there is a carrying capacity of a person in terms of how often they can be in that environment to where it does have some kind of impact long term. Now, that's not necessarily what you see in the movies of somebody going, you know, taking a gun and going on top of a tower, but in fact, a long-term impact upon the way in which they see the world and the way they relate to their family. The second piece, not related to the veteran at all individually, but rather the veteran's family, you get into a situation where the divorce rate has skyrocketed. The divorce rate now with second and third and fourth tours in Iraq and Afghanistan is significant. The longer that we have a situation where people are pulling that many tours, you will have a tremendous impact on the families associated with the veterans and the communities associated with the veterans. Why that's especially important in Oregon is that, as you know, we don't have a large active-duty military base. Our military community largely is the Guard and Reserve. And as the Guard is employed as an operational reserve on a second, third, potentially fourth tour in the out years, you're going to see costs in the family that aren't dollars and cents. So there is a point where too much experience isn't as helpful, but certainly a second or a third tour does help the ability of the unit to perform. But we have to make sure as we develop policies that there are consequences for those actions as well.
Thank you. And I just thinking back in my own experience, it was pre-Vietnam, essentially, before Vietnam really got going. And the Marines, who were all volunteers at the time, had our deployments for a year overseas. And about somewhere late in that year, many of the married people were getting the Dear John letters from their wives who were moving on doing something else. And the other thing, too, that where the federal government needs to really step up and support the reserves. We're having so few people in the United States are really sacrificing anything for the Middle East operations. And now we're calling on our reserves and not properly taking care of them education-wise. In the days when Representative Scott and I were in the service, the reserves were used. A lot of people saw that as a way to get around the draft and not really serve. I mean, you'd put in your time, but it was the 1 weekend a month, 2 weeks a year. And you know, if there's anything wrong with that, because they were, you know, ready to be called up if they were needed, but they weren't called up, and now they are called up, so the country needs to take care of these people. We're sending our young women over there, and I saw one on TV the other day who's lost her legs, so that other people's sons can stay home and party and have a good time and not need to worry about it. And I would hope that the people in Congress of this country would take a look at the fact that their kids aren't over there and other people's are, and would do something to provide for the future. And I will leave it at that. Representative Shoffler.
Mr. Chair, thank you. You know, my life ain't changed a bit, not one bit, due to these situations where we're over there. And I am not alone. I'd say every family here, unless you have a member or a friend or a neighbor that you know, and there's plenty of that. And I have the Willamette National Cemetery in my district, a stone's throw from my house. So I shouldn't say it hasn't changed a bit, because I've seen the processions and the governor's car and all that going by. So I probably should retake that statement. But my personal life, my security, my everyday routine has not changed one bit. And that, I think that is unfortunate that we are not stepping up and being asked to do something. Who would reenlist after a second tour? I mean, you may as well be full-time Army or full-time military, because, for God's sakes, now we're talking about third and fourth deployment. Holy cannoli. I mean, you're not going to have anybody reenlisting.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Shoffler, I'll take a shot, and then I'll hand over to General Colwell. I can't speak for others. I can speak for myself. The only reason I'm still in the Air National Guard at this point is because there's a potential of deploying again and serving with the kids that I trained.
Well, God bless you.
There's a connection between service and the folks you serve with, mm-hmm. and there is a connection without getting too much into a lot of the details. There is a relationship that's formed when you are responsible for young men and women, especially And I'm not certain of this, but I believe the current reenlistment rate is about 101%. I think because you don't want to be the guy or gal that leaves your buddy having to take that extra tour. I mean, it's counterintuitive, but you don't want to be the person that makes the other person's life harder because you've been there, you've done that, and you have a responsibility. And in my own case, one of the reasons that I actually was a part of the 2003 invasion when I was on a different mission altogether, the reason I was requested was because there just weren't a lot of people that did what I used to do, and they needed someone that could train young lieutenants and captains. But you get into a situation where you have to believe what you're doing matters. And even though you may or may not have any impact at all on the bigger battle, you go, you keep your kids alive, you do the missions you can, and you don't want to let the country down, you don't want to let your peers down. And so actually I think through the duration of this conflict, I suspect that in the National Guard you're still going to see a lot of people remaining in. My concern, as I said before, sir, is when the music stops, the war is over, still having a National Guard that can meet the challenges that we can't foresee.
Yeah. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Shoffler, I think retention numbers, as Paul indicated, have never been better. We haven't had this kind of retention since Vietnam. We have recruited more people than we've ever recruited in the last 2 years. First time in since probably 1973, 74, that the Oregon National Guard has been over 100% in strength. Now, a lot of that has to do with what Paul indicated. A lot of it has to do with finances. There's a $15,000 reenlistment bonus if you sign up while you're in Iraq or Afghanistan, tax-free. That certainly makes a difference, and I think and it's hard to say what the typical guardsman is or isn't, because we are the butcher, baker, candlestick maker of every community. But a good number of our young people come in, and they're high school graduates. They haven't decided whether or not they want to go on to college. They think they do, but they haven't got the means, or they just haven't got the energy or the emphasis to do that. They haven't matured enough to do that. When they typically, about 21, 22, 23, they end up getting married. They have a spouse, a child, and then all of a sudden they're working at a fairly typical minimum wage or low-end kind of a job. We deploy them, all of a sudden they make more money than they've made, they get a $15,000 bonus, and those are all very enticing to a young person who doesn't have post-secondary education, which back to my earlier comment about the importance, I believe, in getting these people retrained, getting them education, getting them associate degrees, or getting them some sort of skill that they already have that they can foster into the civilian community and actually make a life work out of it. And I think that's the best thing we could do for our people, because so many of them are in that category where they don't have that post-secondary education. And then they're competing against people who didn't serve, who come back, and they're ahead of them in the job line. And many of them come back, and they're not going to go back. I mean, we give them tremendous responsibility. Young men and women at 21, 22, 23 years old, life and death decision-making capability. We tell them to look out for their fellow soldiers, and they do. And then all of a sudden they're going to come back and go back to a minimum wage flipping hamburger job. They can't do it. They simply cannot do that. So now, and that's one of our big efforts in our reintegration team, is finding jobs, employers who will employ these people with a family wage job that has insurance, that has the things that we all expect we should have, and getting these kids employed with those employers. We've got 200, we've placed over 300 people so far in the last 3 years with our jobs program, and we're continuing to look for employers who will take, and frankly, I got to tell you, Oregon employers have been extremely good. I mean, we've had some excellent, excellent response. They want these young men and women because they know that they're going to show up on time. It just amazes me when I talk to them. Every time I talk to them, I'm just shaking my head because they say, what I want, I don't need a kid who's got all the whiz bang training in the world. I don't care if they know how to, put a bolt or a nut on a bolt. I'll teach them that. I want somebody who's going to show up on time. I know they're going to be there 5 days a week. I know they're going to be drug free, and I know that they know how to take orders and learn. That's what I'm looking for, because I can't find that in the general population. So that's played to our benefit with respect to that. But again, it's difficult in some communities because they don't have the ability out there, particularly in Eastern Oregon. They just don't have the job skills. They don't have the industry. They don't have the places where people need that kind of work. So that's one of our bigger problems.
One more comment, Mr. Chair, and I'll shut up, I promise. The things that you two gentlemen just said, that's what I want to read in the paper. Some scribbler should be here writing this down, and the big mouths on the radio and TV should be talking about this. Because, Mr. Evans, Paul, you answered my question, and God bless you for being willing. I cannot commend you enough. But and then the point that Oregon employers are stepping up, you know, where and when they can, and that's what I want to hear about, and I think that's what people need to hear about. So thank you for indulging me, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. The next item on the agenda is the possible approval of legislative concept number 7 for introduction. I'll open a public hearing on that matter. Paula Brown. I don't know if Raven's come up one at a time, maybe. And Mac, you could come up too and be ready if you would, please. Thank you, Ms. Brown. Go ahead, please.
Mr. Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paula Brown. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and I just wanted to take the opportunity to thank this committee for the good work that you've done and for your continued demonstrated commitment to veterans and taking a look at what possible gaps exist in services and benefits to veterans in the state of Oregon and then developing ways to address those. So that's really what I'm here for, is just to thank you for taking a look at and developing this legislative concept and considering its introduction in helping veterans. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. McDonald.
My name is Matt McDonald, United Veterans of Oregon. I read over LC7. I have one proposed change to it on page 2, line 30. I propose that we change the discharged under honorable conditions rather than dishonorable discharge, because there's more than one discharge that's non-honorable. And if you put discharge under honorable conditions, that'll cover no matter how the law changes. There's always going to be honorable, and there's always going to be other than honorable.
So let me understand. So instead of saying must have been discharged with other than a dishonorable,
I want to say discharge under honorable conditions.
Under honorable. So that would be...
And we're going to do this for every bill that comes through. I know there is some in law in many places that says this, but the United Veterans of Oregon feels that it's fairer if you say discharge under honorable conditions, because there are conditions. You can have a general discharge, not under honorable conditions. Administrative discharge, not under honorable conditions. This eliminates those people. And the bill other than that is a good bill.
It seemed like they had like undesirable discharge, which is not a dishonorable. Dishonorable is pretty hard to come by, really.
Right. Yeah. If you get dishonorable discharge, you're going to spend 12 months normally in Leavenworth.
Well, Mr. Chair, can someone explain to me discharge under not honorable, but not... there's categories here I'm not familiar with. Can you explain to me what these discharges are?
I don't have them in front of me, but they had... Sometimes you... For some reason, you're not doing well, so they're going to let you out of the military. And if you have a fairly honorable record, you get a general discharge rather than an honorable, honorable conditions. But if you have been in trouble, then it's less than honorable conditions. A dishonorable discharge is very serious, and they don't give very many of those out. I mean, that's like a super felony kind of thing.
My question, Mr. Chair, is general. What? Okay, there's honorable, general, less than honorable, and then dishonorable. I need general and less than honorable described to me.
Other than honorable.
Whatever.
Okay, Mr. Evans, if you could help us with that.
Explain this to me.
Paul Evans, policy advisor to Governor Pogoski, and for the record, I think this change is good, fine. I mean, there's when I was active duty in the Air Force, and it sometimes changes, but there were four categories: honorable discharge, administrative discharge is generally happens within the first 4 months of service. Person comes in, everybody realizes this person just really shouldn't be in the military. The fourth category, dishonorable, is in fact, I believe, at least at the time, it was a felony. I mean, you have done some, generally some kind of crime or some kind of activity that is against the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and it's decided that not only should you be a civilian, but in fact you should be a civilian with sanction, that we don't want people thinking that you were a veteran. The third category, general, is that, let me, honorable, general, administrative. Administrative in general can be appealed and can be, through the Veterans Administration, can actually be upgraded if there's extra information available. So it's a very fair system. There is an appeal system. And general and administrative are under the same basic concept that the person didn't do anything bad enough to warrant a felony, but shouldn't continue in the military. Administrative is generally more specifically related to a criteria that the military has for service. The general is sometimes one of those things where a person, let's just say, in my own experience, there was an airman that was a troublemaker that didn't really want to be in the Air Force, had not done anything particularly damaging to the Air Force, but was just a constant trouble. And when I had to get kids ready to go to war, I didn't want to have to worry about this guy. So he didn't want to be in the Air Force. He had a four-year commitment. I didn't want him in my Air Force. We met with the JAG. We worked out a deal, and he got out. No sanction, but not the full benefits of an honorable discharge. I don't know if that was the case.
That's basically it.
Great.
So what I would say was, on that line, would starting in late 29, the veteran must have been discharged under honorable conditions.
That's it.
Okay. Thank you.
Or Mr. Chair, or under honorable discharge, just keep the last word.
Discharged under honorable conditions.
On your discharge, when you get discharged from service, it'll say either under honorable conditions or not under honorable conditions.
All right, I'm there. Thank you.
And just for simplicity, when this thing goes through, every military member when they get out gets a DD Form 214, and that will list those details. So this isn't anything that the member doesn't know themselves. It's very black and white.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Levy.
Good morning, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, I am Harlan Levy, now the Oregon State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business. NFIB is the nation's leading advocacy group for small business with approximately 7,500 members here in Oregon. And I'm honored, privileged to appear before you. I've never appeared before this committee before in my previous capacity. And I'm here today to offer NFIB support for LC7. We think this is a wonderful idea, and we appreciate this committee bringing this LC draft forward. And I want to thank the Department of Veterans Affairs for inviting me here today to offer our testimony in support of the bill. We think that this is an excellent program, a way to assist these veterans when they come back and their small businesses have suffered because of their deployment, and we encourage you to support this bill and move it along in the process. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Nope.
Thank you, Mr. Slimy.
Thank you.
I think we will introduce this bill, or I'd like to introduce the bill, but with the change that we talked about on line 30. Okay. And then before we go ahead with this, I just want to add a disclaimer. Traditionally, committees have pre-session filed legislation for the sole purpose of expediting business for the upcoming session. A courtesy vote for the introduction of a measure today does not necessarily indicate a member's support for the measure at this time or at any time in the future. It does not guarantee the leadership will send the bill to the Veterans Affairs Committee or that such bill will ever receive a hearing. With that said, would somebody like to make a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move that LC7, as corrected on line 30, be recommended for introduction at the February 2008 special session.
Okay, thank you. Representative Scott moves that we introduce the bill as amended for the February 2008 special session. Is there any discussion?
Only to say, Mr. Chair, it should become a bill. It should be assigned to this committee. It should get a hearing. We should pass it and should become the law.
Other than that, nope.
Those of the opinion that LC 7 be recommended for introduction at the February 2008 special session will answer aye as their name is called. Those opposed, no. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative
Boquist? He's no longer on the committee, I don't think. Or is he?
So I guess he's excused.
Representative Shepler?
Aye.
Representative Scott?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion passes. Is there any further business to come before the committee today? Seeing none, we'll stand adjourned.